This is Five Aspects of Woman, Lesson 6, entitled Helper, Completer, Created. I would like to make two notes before I begin to read. One, there is not a Lesson 5 in the audio series because Lesson 5 is an application lesson. Also, there are some very important footnotes in the lessons that it is not my custom to read the footnotes. So I'd really urge you to read your text and read the footnotes for more information and also for the credits to various quotes. There are five main sections in this lesson. The creation of the sexes, a harmony of Genesis 1 and 2 is the first. The second is the nature of the sexes, then helping and completing the man through marriage. Fourth, helping and completing the man through partnership, and finally, the headship of the man. Genesis 1 presents us with an overview of Creation Week. Its teaching on the image of God in man and woman and the world mandate are the foundation of the mistress aspect, which we have just studied. Genesis 2 amplifies day 6 of Creation Week. This second amplified creation account provides us with rich details about the individual creation of man and woman, the first job, the first marriage, and the first home. Thus, Genesis 2 provides our second definitive passage on woman, and as such is the foundation of the helper-completer aspect of woman, the second of the five created aspects described in this study. As the mistress aspect focused on woman's relationship to God and nature, the helper aspect focuses on woman's relationship to man. Harmonies of the Gospels blend Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John to make a chronological and more complete story of Jesus' life. In a similar way, let us use details from both Genesis 1 and 2 to reconstruct day 6 of creation, in order to understand better this very important second view of woman's creation. Early on the sixth day, God makes the animals from the dust of the ground. Then someplace outside of Eden, we are not told exactly where, God takes dust and makes a human body, a male body. God breathes into this male body a spirit, the breath of life. This body, made from dust and infused with spirit directly from God, becomes Adam, the first living soul. Next, God marks out the boundaries of Eden and plants a garden inside this new area. God places the man in the garden. Adam could have walked to the garden from the place he was created, or God could have miraculously transferred him, as he did with Philip on the road to Gaza in Acts 8. We don't know exactly how it happened. The point is that Adam does not start out in the Garden of Eden. He is made somewhere else and is brought to his territory. Notice that God is the one who starts the business of making boundaries, naming things, and cultivating the earth by planting a garden. He is the earth's first husbandman, the first gardener. God brings Adam to this first cultivated territory as his protege, teaches him to speak, and begins to show him his domain. God gives Adam specific commands and a commission to guard and keep this garden. God is Adam's father, king, boss, master, trainer, and employer. Filling all of these roles, God puts Adam to work. To get Adam started in his work, God gives him a job with a dual purpose. Adam is to name the animals. God began the naming process in Genesis 1. He named the earth, the sky, the day, and the night in the first days of creation. By continuing God's naming work as God's viceroy, Adam initiates his rule over the animal kingdom by discerning their natures and categorizing them accordingly. However, God has a second purpose for Adam in the naming work. God knows it is not good for the man to be alone. Apparently, Adam does not yet know this. But God knows that Adam is not complete. He is not sufficient to be and to do all that God has for mankind to be and do. It probably occurs to Adam, as he sees all these animals in twos, that he is not one of two. He is one alone. Adam has fellowship with God, of course, and he has fellowship with the animals. But he has no human fellowship. The text says, "But for Adam there was not found a helper suitable for him." Chapter 2, verse 20. In all likelihood, God and Adam discussed the situation. Perhaps God says something like this to Adam, "I will provide a mate, a helper for you, but you must cooperate with me. You must trust me and be willing to go to sleep, to give up your life for a little while. If you do this, I will open your side and take out part of your body, part of your own flesh and bone. Beginning with that, I will make someone specially for you." It seems apparent that Adam knowingly and willingly gives up his life temporarily to gain a mate for himself. Whether or not this conversation took place, God does put Adam to sleep, opens his side, and takes out some flesh and bone. He does not leave Adam with his side open. God closes up the place, we are told in verse 21. Thus completing Adam's surgery. Then, working from the starter flesh and bone he has taken from Adam, God builds the first female body. It follows that God also breathes into her body the spirit of life, and this new creation becomes a living person. Adam does not take part in this work. He is off to the side, perhaps under a tree, just waking from the divine anesthesia. Next, we are told that God brought her to the man. This word "brought" is a general word, but it is used frequently for bringing a gift to honor a person or an offering to God. God brings the woman to the man. We can imagine Christ in his pre-incarnate form actually bringing this new creature by the hand and presenting her to the man. Adam responds with the first poetry of history. In verse 23, he says, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." The original language is full of animation, emotion, and personal pronouns, which we might loosely paraphrase like this. "Wow, she's from me. She's like me. She's for me. This is woman." So there is great joy on the part of the man when he receives the gift of woman from the hand of God. We can imagine God giving Adam and the woman some time to get acquainted. Perhaps they talked about their creation experiences. Their experiences were a bit different, but the same in one dramatic way. Both Adam and woman awoke in their Creator's hand. The first thing each beheld was God Himself and the world around them. First of all, we are made for God. Secondarily, we are brought to one another. In woman's case, this comes very quickly. She is made, she is brought to the man. There in the garden, the first human fellowship in all of history took place. Adam might have told his new companion, "I have tried this fruit, I have named this animal, and this is what I call it. We are not supposed to eat of that tree, but we can't eat from all the rest of these trees." Eve could take all this in on two levels. First, being a creature in the image of God, made to rule the earth for God, she is very interested in the animals and birds and plants for their own sakes. Yet she finds Adam fascinating and interesting in a unique way. She listens on two levels. She learns the objective things he is telling her about the created world, and on another level she studies him, his speech, his eyes, the way he looks, what he does, how he moves, his sense of humor, everything, because she was also made from him and for him. Made from the man and for the man, she has a special capacity to focus on her man and on the personal. After all these events, God performs the first wedding. In this particular wedding, the father of the bride is also the father of the groom and the ruling authority. He has the authority to perform the wedding service, and in this case, not only perform the wedding, but also to institute marriage for all time. He gives the bride, his own daughter, away to his own son Adam, proclaiming that now the two shall be one. After the wedding, God commissions the human pair with a great worldwide mandate of Genesis 1:28. At the end of the day, he blesses them and says, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth, and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." God has made the man, he has made the woman, and he has brought them together in marriage. Now to the two of them, this wedded pair, male and female, man and woman, husband and wife, he gives the great authority and challenge of ruling the world for him, because only together can they do it. This is what we know of mankind's first day of human life. God created man and woman in counterpoint. Webster first defines counterpoint as one or more independent melodies added above or below a given melody. The second definition is the combination of two or more independent melodies into a single harmonic texture in which each retains its linear character. What a beautiful and accurate description of human sexuality as God created it. Adam stood in the garden as an independent melody, clear and strong. But his melody, as great as it was, lacked dimension. It was a melody alone. Then God composed another independent melody with its own linear character. This second melody was written in counterpoint to the first. When God brought the second melody to combine with the first, the garden was filled with harmony more beautiful and full than either melody alone. Then the composer was content that his work was finished and very good. We need to emphasize that man and woman are alike. Our commonality makes our wonderful range of fellowship possible. We are both from God. We have the mandate from God. We have mind, conscience, will, and personality in God's image. All the things that make us human, we have in common. We have bodies from the earth that are alike in most ways. We can eat the same food, walk the same paths, and sit on the same furniture. We are both under God and the angels and over the earth and the animals. The commonality of man and woman is vast and basic to our companionship and teamwork. Great emphasis is laid on these common elements in the mistress of the domain aspect, which we studied first. That aspect comes first for a reason. We never want to detract from the common and equal value of the image of God which belongs to man and woman. Yet, another crucial part of man and woman's fellowship is based on our very real differences. To be biblical Christians, we must hold to both of these truths. Man and woman are equally human, both fully in the image of God, yet we are significantly different from the beginning. We can see the outline of these differences in Genesis 2. If we examine this chapter closely, we will see differences inherent from the beginning in the way man and woman were made from the hand of God. Man was created from the earth and was then brought to the earth, the garden, and began his work there. Woman was created from the man, was brought to the man, and began her work there by his side. Man was given the garden mandate all by himself, before the woman existed. Man was warned about death before woman existed. Man named the woman when he said, "This is woman. She has come out of my side." Woman is the named one. She receives a significant part of her identity from her relationship with her man. Woman is a gift God gave to man. Man should be the initiator of marriage. The original institution of marriage recorded in verse 24 says, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Adam did not have a human father and mother. God was his father. We know this from Luke 3:38, and the earth was his only mother. But this verse is not written only for Adam and Eve. This verse institutes marriage for all time. The pattern is that a man should initiate marriage by leaving his parents and joining with his wife. Many people claim you can never say anything definite about sexuality because there are too many cultural differences. Cultural differences do exist, but these should not be used to obliterate the universal and God-given categories of male and female. From the beginning, God created man with abiding masculine traits and woman with abiding feminine traits, which transcend history and culture. The roots of some of these basic traits of man and woman can be seen in Genesis 2. Men tend to be nature-focused. Women tend to be people-focused. In general, men, more than women, are interested in things, impersonal nature forces, machines, abstract ideas, and scientific thinking. On the other hand, women are more interested in people, relationships, feelings, and nuances of conversation. It is not far-fetched to see a link between these traits in Genesis 2. Man was made from nature for a focus on nature. Adam was made from the earth and brought to the earth to cultivate it. Woman, on the other hand, is from a person and for people. She was made from the man and brought to the man to begin her work by his side. She was made through a two-step process. Dust was made into human flesh, then human flesh was made into a female body. Both steps represent divine miracles. She is and ought to be a more refined and delicate vessel. Men are like crude clay pots intended for rougher work, often out of doors. Women are like delicate vases intended for more sensitive and personal work, often indoors. Men tend to be objective. They focus on what is. Women tend to be subjective. They focus on how people feel about what is. The man will notice if the mail is late. The woman will notice if the postman is depressed. Both viewpoints are valid. Both viewpoints are very important, but they are not the same viewpoint. They are complementary viewpoints. Men tend to be task-oriented, women relationship-oriented. Men tend to be the risk-takers. God brought Adam from the outer world to a new place to start a new work under God's authority. Men are created to take initiative, to go forth, to gain something new. They are the ones who from the foundation of the world are to leave home in order to build a new one. Women are more oriented to security. It is not an accident that Eve was created in an inhabited garden. It was a secure, bounded place. A man was already there. God was there. It was a lovely place to be. The willingness to risk to gain more and the concern to keep what one has are both valid impulses. No family or people will endure without both of these drives functioning in harmony. We cannot analyze all the different male and female tendencies. The point to emphasize is this. The Bible teaches that man and woman are equal in their humanity and different in their sexuality. Both the equality and differences predate all cultures because they are both rooted in creation itself, as revealed in Genesis. The rest of this lesson concerns three topics: how woman helps man in marriage, in partnership, and in response to his headship. The next paragraph is a chart that reviews the created differences of man and woman. I will read the chart. There is a column of what applies to man and what applies to woman. Man was made first. Woman was made second. Man was made from the earth. Woman was made from man, the person. Man was made in an uninhabited world. Woman was made in an inhabited garden. Man was brought to his territory by God. Woman was brought to her man by God. Man was created to work the earth. Woman was created to help the man. Man was the namer. Woman was the named. Man was given the garden mandate. Woman enables man to fulfill the garden mandate. Man is the initiator of marriage. Woman was given by God in marriage to man. Man was warned about death by God. Woman was warned about death by Adam. Man is the head of the race. Woman is the last creation of God, completing his work. First God made man, then he made woman from man. Then he made the one flesh of marriage by bringing them together. God did not make a buddy or a pal for Adam. God made a wife for Adam, a far more complicated and wonderful thing. Jesus says in Matthew 19:6 that God is the one who joins man and wife, making them one, warning that this united thing should not be broken or divided by man. The fellowship between the first man and the first woman was exclusive and monogamous, one man for one woman. God did not create polygamy, one man with many wives. He did not create polyandry, one woman with many husbands. He did not create same-sex marriage by forming a clone of Adam to pair with him. God created one woman for one man, intending, commanding, and blessing the two to become and remain one. If it was not good for unfallen Adam to be alone, how much more do sinful men need the track of marriage and the help of godly wives to aid them? God made the woman to be one with the man in order to yoke, harness, focus, and conserve his drives, labors, and virility for the future. The myth of the swinging single is an illusion. Married men are more productive, responsible, healthier, and live longer. Single men, on the other hand, earn less with comparable education, are more often sick, violent, and suicidal. They are more likely to be in mental institutions or jail, and they die younger. The sex act is the consummation of marriage. According to God's design, sexual union is unique to marriage and defines it. The culminating and symbolic representation of the whole relationship of marriage, it is the essential act of joint productivity. It is the inalienable right of marriage which cannot be annexed righteously to any other relationship. After the shift from God worship to self worship, what people do with their sex drive is the most telling harbinger of their future. In this one decision, a society decides whether its core orientation will be one of self-control or one of self-gratification. Its final goal, the long-term blessedness of the family, the nation, and God, or the short-term pleasures of the individual. Genesis 2:25 says, "And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." Without clothes, veils, or shields, sinless Adam and Eve experienced perfect oneness and no shame in the sexual and personal relationship of marriage. There was no break in the fellowship because there was no break in the trust. In the next chapter, we will see the catastrophic break of trust. Then we will see the break in perfect intimacy. Nevertheless, the created ideal is that the fellowship of man and woman would be characterized by both exclusivity and intimacy. Today, even in our fallen condition, the greatest psychosexual stability, peace, and fulfillment exist among the married. Many who honor God's ways, even imperfectly, find a private world in marriage where our bed, our home, our children, our wealth, and our lifetime have true meaning. Indeed, Hebrews 13:4 says, "The marriage bed is undefiled, but adulterers and fornicators God will judge." Whatever the advocates of free sex proclaim, there is no sex outside of marriage without guilt and shame. Those who say differently do so only as liars, in self-deception, and from consciences that are hard and even seared. Genesis 2:5 states that there were no agricultural crops before Adam because there was no man to cultivate the ground. The word translated cultivate is a simple word which means to work or serve. From the beginning, man was created to be a worker of the earth. This fact will be greatly reemphasized in the unhappy context of the curse in Genesis 3. Nevertheless, before the curse, God gave Adam the garden mandate, as we have seen. This mandate has two commands. First, to work or cultivate. Second, to keep and maintain the garden. I am indebted to my husband for pointing out to me that God gave Adam a job bigger than he could do by himself, part of which he was not actually suited to do, the work of keeping and maintaining. Thus we have a clue from the text about why it is not good for the man to be alone. He was primarily a cultivator, not a keeper. When God made woman and brought her to the man, he provided him a completing helper because she was specially equipped to do what he was not suited to do. Together, they could do the work God had for them. Throughout history, man has gone out to expand and conquer new territories, while woman has stayed back to maintain and keep what has already been conquered. The whole conquest of the globe has followed this pattern. Through the centuries, men have sought to discover the world by sailing seas, crossing mountains, and forging rivers. In almost every case, the wives of the explorers have stayed home. The men go out and discover things, then come back with new resources, new knowledge, traded goods, or new treasures. Meantime, the women maintain whatever possessions, family, or accumulations they already have. This is the pattern that Moses recalls in Deuteronomy 3:16-20. God commanded the able-bodied Reubenite and Gadite men to go over the Jordan to help their brothers conquer Canaan. But their wives and children were commanded to stay with their livestock, maintaining the land that the Reubenites and Gadites had been given already on the east side of Jordan. Thus their inheritance would be preserved for their return. We might ask, which is more important, conquering or maintaining, getting or keeping? 1 Samuel 30 answers this important question. The scene is this. David's campsite has been plundered. 400 men go to retrieve their possessions. 200 men stay with the baggage. So there are those who go out to get more and those who stay back to keep what they have. When the 400 return, some of them, the Bible says, wicked and worthless men, according to verse 22, some of them say those who stayed back should not get the same reward as those who went out. This is a very common idea today. Many say that going out is more valuable than staying back. The Bible says no. King David says no. In verse 24, he says, "For as his share who goes down to the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike." Lest one think this was a one-time ruling, verse 25 continues, "So it has been from that day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day." This abiding principle is mentioned prior to David in Joshua 22:8, where the fighting Reubenites are sent home after the conquest of Canaan. The fighting men are commanded to divide their plunder with those who stayed home. The truth is that maintaining is just as important a work as getting more. If you overvalue getting more, it is like striving to fill a bucket with a hole in the bottom. You get and get, but you are not keeping, maintaining, or protecting what you have gotten. Therefore, you lose it. Both are needed, someone to get more and someone to keep what you have. Getting and keeping are work of equal value. If you view the work of the homemaker as less valuable than that of her doctor or coal miner husband, then your viewpoint is erroneous and not biblical. Conquering and maintaining are of equal value. Thus, if woman did nothing but stay with the stuff, in God's eyes, her work would be of equal value to getting more. However, as we shall see, woman does a great deal more than merely keep and maintain, as important as that work is. Her labors not only maintain value, her labors add value. This principle is seen in the pattern of man starting work and woman completing it. For a simple example, consider the construction of a house. Usually men dig the foundation, pour the concrete, put up the frame, and hammer the nails. The men are concerned with the heating, cooling, plumbing, and overall ability of the house to withstand the forces of nature. On the other hand, most interior decoration is done by women. They manage the colors, pictures, cushions, and carpets. They make it livable for human beings. What if you have one without the other? What if you only have the concrete, the boards, and the roof? Even if you have these, you still have a very low standard of living. How would you like to sit on a concrete floor for supper? But if you only have a pile of pillows, paintings, and potted plants, you will not have a stable standard of living in this case either. You need the two together. We often follow this pattern. Men start things and women complete them. Historically, most inventors, music composers, and even chefs have been men. Deploying their ability to focus on nature, men conquer new frontiers and create new products, whether in the area of technology, music, or food. However, after this ground is initially conquered, it is women who maintain and dispense the fruits of their initial labors, cooking most of our food, playing and teaching music in the local community, and using all the machines and gadgets which make our lives more enjoyable and free. A much more weighty example of man as starter and woman as completer is marriage and family. Man needs to initiate marriage. God says, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife." A man must pursue a woman, marry her, and make love to her. If he doesn't, there will be no marriage or family. But if a woman does not agree to marry the man and respond to his sexual advances and be willing to bear his children, there will be no children and there will be no family. In fact, the woman has the power to make marriage, family, and home a reality. Man must initiate, woman must respond. Only by his leading and her responding are family and home created. Whatever men produce in the outer domain, whether they bring home a buffalo or a paycheck, tend a herd of yaks, or create an inventory of widgets, their work is not complete. Whatever is produced must be transformed into cooked food, a livable dwelling, clothes that fit, social occasions, and meaningful heritage. All these must be created, maintained, and projected into the future if the mandate for godly civilization is to be fulfilled. Deceived people think money can solve anything. Maids, cooks, chauffeurs, interior decorators, nannies, even sexual partners, all can be hired, if your morals allow that. One can assemble a collection of economic transactions in the configuration of a human crash pad. But this will not be a home. A home cannot be bought. Its essential ingredients, commitment, faith, love, labor, sacrifice, shared history, and the continuity of godly seed, these are not for sale. These human virtues are spiritual capital, and they exist only in men who are willing to be providing husbands and in the homemaking wives who complete them. To summarize, women bring great value by keeping what has been produced. They add value by completing works which men start, especially as they produce children and build individual families and homes. On a larger scale, just as woman is indispensable in the work of building the home, so she is essential in the work of building civilization itself. In this final pattern of conquering and civilizing, the first two patterns, that is, getting and keeping, starting and completing, are subsumed and exalted. For example, consider the taming of the American West. Men started the conquest of the unknown and lawless West, and women finished the conquest by bringing civilization, homes, schools, churches, and culture. I was fascinated by Alasdair Cook's commentary in his video series called America, A Personal History of the United States. Part 7 is entitled Domesticating a Wilderness. In the previous segment, he developed the idea that the West was first explored by trappers, miners, and cowboys. These men learned about the land, its resources, and what it could produce, whether gold, furs, or pasture. Then in Part 7 he says this, I quote, "The homesteaders, they introduced the new and stable element, the family. In the end, the West was won by the homesteader and his woman, the mother of the first generation raised on the plains. She was mother, mistress, nurse, seamstress, cook, accountant, comforter, teacher, who was known and treated even by the cowboys and miners as the untouchable Madonna of the plains. Slowly she acquired the symbols of respectability, the dignity of a pony and trap, a frame house, and such high-toned city amenities as wallpaper, carpet, pictures. By the 1890s, it was possible for a strict and pious mother to raise a proud family in a house like this. She it was who usually accompanied the family hymn singing, and in the evenings read aloud books, especially the Good Book, maintaining the frontier tradition which lasted long, perhaps too long in American life, that culture belonged to the women." End quote. Here the point is made beautifully. Men started the process of exploring. They came to know nature. They came to know the plains, the grass, the minerals, the potential. But the women helped them do the work of conquering the continent and bringing civilization by following them and finishing it. Only with the women did they have homes, families, churches, schools, libraries, museums, towns, and all that brings human civilization to maturity. Marriage produces true wealth. In God's system, man goes out to get more, pushing the boundaries with new insights into nature, thus building the frontier engine economy with new crafts and technologies. Woman stays back and keeps, making a truly human habitat. But where homemaking is eschewed, no one keeps. The services once provided and saved up for the family by the homemaker are now exported to the public domain. In this so-called service economy, people are not producing new wealth and conserving it for future generations. In the main, they are only selling maintenance functions, fast food, decorator items, mass-produced clothing, institutional care for children and elderly, and increasingly vacuous entertainments. Where free sex is readily available and marriage is disparaged, there will be a veneer of freedom and wealth as long as the savings of previous generations last. But in the service economy of singles, the engine of true wealth and freedom is forsaken. Woman helps man by working with him in partnership. Whether by completing what he starts or by maintaining what he conquers, her work is indispensable, and their work is interdependent. Woman is not an ornament or afterthought. If she is not with man, the work God gave the human race to do will not be done. Woman helps, she completes, she finishes what man starts. She transforms mere existence to life, sustenance to civilization. The strongholds of man's work will not long exist without her sustaining havens. Her havens will not endure without man's strong defense. By God's design, man and woman are interdependent. They are not interchangeable. In a healthy society, marriage is the usual path of life followed by the vast majority of people. Single people relate around this unit as its sons, daughters, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, and so forth. That marriage and the family form the basic unit of society is illustrated dramatically in 1 Timothy 5, 1-2, in which familial relations are commanded as the paradigm and pattern of all church relations. We are to treat one another as fathers, mothers, brothers, and sisters. These are relationships of the nuclear family, founded in and on marriage. To be sure, the single life is exalted in Scripture. Elijah, John the Baptist, Jesus, and Paul all accomplished their work as single men. However, being a eunuch for the kingdom of God is a rare thing, and the capacity for it is an extraordinary gift from God, according to Matthew 19:10-12. Single households are not proliferating because of this extraordinary gift from God. Rather, the escalating atomization of society is rooted in the autonomous self-gratification and degraded sexuality that permeates our apostate culture. This atomization does not lead to freedom, but to tyranny. Thus far, we have seen that man and woman's fellowship of soul and body in marriage is exclusive, sexual, and intimate. Their partnership in work is interdependent and indispensable. Now let us consider man's headship, woman's membership, and the structure of their roles. Is man's headship, that is, his leadership of and authority over woman, part of the created good beginning of Genesis 2? Or does headship originate in sin, in the fall and curse of Genesis 3? This is a watershed question. How we answer it will determine whether we flow to an egalitarian, non-biblical ocean of feminism, or whether we hold to the unities and hierarchies of Scripture. Adam was made first. Woman was made from him. Woman was made for him. These are the reasons given in the New Testament for man's headship in 1 Corinthians 11, Ephesians 5, and 1 Timothy 2. How God created man and woman in Genesis 2 provides the foundation and structure of the man-woman relationship for all of history. The fall affects the relationship profoundly, as we shall see in the next chapter, but the fall is not the source of man's headship. The created nature of man and woman are the foundation of man's headship of the race. Genesis 2 is a beautiful and poetic story. It is also true history. If the man is the head, what is the woman? What is the other side of this analogy? The woman is the body. Ephesians 5:22-33 says that husbands should love their wives as their own bodies by seeking to nourish and protect them. Christ is the head, and the church is his body. In Genesis 2, we have the foundation of this beautiful truth. In the beginning, woman was made literally from the body of her husband. A healthy head and body work together in harmony and unity. If your friend walks up to embrace you, her arms come out, her eyes light up, her lips smile, her whole body acts in concert in response to her head's direction to greet you warmly. You see harmony, oneness, and a flow of action that is organic and fluid. This is based upon the fact that all of her body recognizes the authority of her head's instruction. At the same time, a healthy head is very concerned to receive continual feedback from the body. The head might say, "Let's jump in the water." The body puts the toe in the water and sends the signal back, "This water is much too cold. Let's not jump into the water." And the head says, "All right, let's not." Or you cross your legs and your foot says, "I'm going to sleep. Please uncross me." The head will signal back, "Okay, uncross." Usually the head does what is necessary to please the body, unless there is a good reason not to do so. Unfortunately, a foolish head does not heed its body's signals. The body says, "You are eating too much. Stop. You are drinking too much or working too long." So the foolish head that does not heed the body's warnings will probably do harm to the whole. However, the head has the authority and responsibility to do what is best for the body and overrule the body if necessary. For instance, the body doesn't want a needle poked into it, but the head knows the inoculation is in the best long-term interest of the body. The head of a sane, healthy person will do what is best for its body at all times and will instinctively try to please its body if possible. On the other hand, if you see a head saying, "All right, hand, now pick up the spoon," and you see the hand arduously fighting back, refusing to pick up the spoon, you would think something is drastically wrong. You would assume this person has a paralysis or some kind of nerve disorder. A husband-wife relationship full of commands, resistance, servility, or anger is the spiritual equivalent of a spastic or quadriplegic. A natural, flowing, organic relationship has been destroyed and replaced with a mechanical, pathological one. When things function correctly, we may even lose sight of the basis of the harmony. A godly man and his wife read an article advocating no headship and total mutuality in marriage. The article put a great deal of emphasis on oneness and harmony in marriage. The husband said, "This sounds like our marriage. We have wonderful unity and harmony. The wife giggled and said, "You don't know how much I submit to you." She told me later, "My husband is a natural leader, and I am committed to being a godly wife, so I consciously seek to follow him." What it produces in our life is a sense of oneness and a great deal of harmony. When the husband is committed to receive the response and feedback of his wife, to protect her and be concerned for her every want and need, and when the wife is committed to follow and respect the directives and wishes of her husband, they will experience harmony and unity. You will not see obsequious or tyrannical behavior. The Bible never uses a military metaphor for marriage. That is the wrong picture for married authority and response. The right picture is the organic unity of the body and the head. The picture and the historic truth of Genesis 2 is that woman came from the body of man to be loved by him as his own body. The helper-completer aspect is part of every woman's being, whether she is married or not. Every woman will decide whether she will seek to complete and complement men and what they do, or will oppose and compete with them. The drive to marry is very strong in almost all people, whether male or female. Genesis 2 explains why this is so. If you are married, seek to apply these helper-completer principles directly to your marriage. If you are not married, your success as a woman and as a person still rests largely on your honoring these sexual patterns and principles. All these principles, objectivity and subjectivity, conquest and maintenance, risk and security, headship and membership, must be applied if we are to fulfill our humanity, our sexuality, and the work God gave us to do.